Welcome to everyone who's not normally here. Thrilled that you would join us this morning and get to see all the cute babies, grandchildren. I'm thrilled that you're here. We've been in the middle of a series where we've been exploring these wilderness paths of Scripture. Oh, wanted to add, there is child programming. No pressure, you don't have to, but if you want, next door there is child programming if you want to take your children there. If not, they're more than welcome to stay in here, and I will do my best to keep them very interested. So we've been moving through these wilderness paths of Scripture, and this week it brings us to the Gospel of John. We move from Matthew and Mark, moves us to the Gospel of John. I'll be upfront and very honest here from the beginning. The Gospel of John's context is just so much less interesting than the background to Matthew and Mark. It's just not that interesting. Many scholars suggest John was written for a broader set of churches in Asia, and it was comprised of both Jews and Gentiles, but unlike Matthew and Mark, John's listeners, they were not in the dramatic throes of change or suffering. But John asks us, it seems, through his book, he just asks us to slow down, to rest, to receive. John, you could say, coaches us to pause along our wilderness paths in life in order to rejuvenate, refresh ourselves. And so his letter is much more artistic in nature. It's got these fascinating images in it, primarily of gardens and weddings. Gardens and weddings. The first chapter of John begins with these words, "In the beginning." And so it echoes back to the book of Genesis. John is reworking the themes of Genesis into a new story of paradise being recovered through Christ. The garden, for those of you not familiar with Genesis, in the Genesis story, people are ejected from this garden paradise, and John's reworking the story so that now everyone is invited back in. And so John opens with this invitation to this idyllic paradise garden setting. And then in chapter 2, the invitation is to come to a wedding. We have this famous story of Jesus turning water into wine. He's at a wedding, the wine runs out, and so the wedding is cut short because what kind of party doesn't have wine at it, right? So Jesus fills the jugs. He begins to usher in a world where the wine never runs out, the celebration never ends. And so John's book begins with these two thematic invitations. Come to this garden of rest. Come to this wedding celebration. It's a time, John reminds us, that while we can expect change and suffering on our journeys, we can also expect to encounter joy. What exactly do we mean by joy, though? Joy is such an odd word, don't you think? Not exactly one that we use very often. I'm not sure about you, but for me, rarely does the word joy make an appearance in my casual conversations. Rarely do I hear someone sort of say, "I was filled with a rapturous and glorious joy." It would be better if people did talk like that. But rarely do I hear people sort of speak of this joy. It's such a bizarre word. It seems like a bit of a relic. And Warren picked up on this. Is there a difference between joy and happiness? I think we throw around the word happy a lot, but we throw around the word love a lot too. And so if we're talking about instant gratification, then sure, I'm not sure happiness is something to pursue. But outside of casual use, most of the people I know, I don't know about you, but when people speak of sort of a true deep happiness, I think they're looking for some kind of enduring state of being that's with us even during the tough times of life. Something we can face and have even in our grief and pain. And so I think joy or true happiness that we long for, it's about our internal disposition, not external circumstances. But what exactly is true joy? What exactly is deep happiness? Here's my hunch. I'm not sure about all of the contours of joy or deep, true happiness, but I think at its core, when we speak about joy or true happiness, most of us are talking about gratitude. Gratitude. There's a huge volume of literature out there about the science of happiness. It's fascinating stuff. Consistently, this body of work and research, it tells us that gratitude is one of the most common traits found among the happiest people in the world. The happiness or true joy, it would seem, it goes hand in hand with gratitude. It was Brené Brown, actually, who first helped me think and draw the lines between these two dots. She quotes, who does she quote? David Rast there. It says, "It's not joy that makes us grateful, it's gratitude that makes us joyful." Gratitude is the source of this internal state of joy. And here's the thing about gratitude that I find fascinating is that it doesn't depend on circumstances, and it can exist even in times of heartache. Things don't have to be going well for you to feel gratitude. In fact, I've been amazed to see so many people that in the face of loss or grief, their gratitude actually increases. So I've become that joy is another name for gratitude. And this is the invitation we receive from John. Come to the garden of gratitude. Come to the wedding of gratitude. Simply come to receive joy. And his letter is filled with these images of joy and gardens and weddings. But it's also full of cautionary tales that speak to what robs us and keeps us from joy and gratitude. So I want to share two stories and make some fascinating observations here. This is an interesting one from John 12. It says this: 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus raised from the dead. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. One of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." Now, he did not say this because he actually cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself all the time. "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." I love this story. It's so wonderful and instructive. You have Mary here who understands this moment. She recognizes the gift of the moment. Jesus won't be with them long. She recognizes that, and she doesn't want to wait for a funeral to express how she feels, and so she does this beautiful act. She understands this dinner, this moment is pure gift, and she expresses gratitude for it. And then you have Jesus who defends her. In fact, in Mark, Jesus says it was a beautiful thing that she did, because Jesus recognizes this moment as pure gift. He's grateful for this gesture, sees it as a beautiful thing. And then, of course, you have Judas. And his response was essentially this: this story, this moment with the perfume, it could have had a different ending that was better than this. This situation could have been better if it had been played out differently. And so he sees the situation, the moment, and all he can focus on is how things could have been better. Would have been better if this was used for the poor. And John reminds us, I love it, this had nothing to do with the poor. This had everything to do with Judas's internal state. And you know, I think the thing is this. I think nothing kills our joy and keeps us from gratitude more than this. Wishing this was actually something else. Wishing our current situation was somehow different. Thinking this moment, this person, this relationship, this body, my job, my community, my church was somehow better. And I think Jesus and Judas's response, they highlight something powerful. Jesus sees the moment as pure gift with a sense of gratitude, and all Judas can see are its flaws. This could have been better. Chris and I were married. We had a honeymoon in Cuba. It was a long travel day. Arrived in Cuba, had another 90-minute bus ride to our resort at the beach. We got to our resort, and there's a little thing they give you after you get married, a little proof of marriage slip thing they give you. And I have been told through the grapevine, you sort of show this, you can get yourself some free upgrades. And so that's what I did. Came up to the counter after a long travel day. I sort of said, "Hey, we just got married." And they said, "Wonderful, we're going to upgrade you to one of our honeymoon suites with an ocean view." I thought, delightful, wonderful. So up we went to the room, opened the door. I carried Kristen across the threshold. You should know I'm lying. No, of course I didn't. I was like, "Could you hold my bag for me?" No. We both just entered the room regularly, and I was so excited. Here we were on our honeymoon. We'd finally arrived in our room. And I went to open the screen door, looking out to the glorious ocean, and I opened it up, and there was a brick wall. So what is this? What? A brick wall? I thought we were in a honeymoon suite. I opened the door. I stepped out onto the balcony, and the brick wall was here. And if you tilted your head over, and you could just see the ocean, that way. I was incensed. I was filled with rage. What an injustice. So I started raging. This is ridiculous. They upgrade me. I would like to see what your normal rooms are like. Hello. And I remember Kristen, she's like, we're here. Let's go get a drink. Let's enjoy ourselves. And I said, I don't think so. Someone's going to hear about this. So I'm calling the front desk. Oh, we don't have any other rooms. I'm like, well, that's not good enough. You upgraded me to, oh, it was awful. I remember at one point, Kristen came. She put her arms around my shoulder. She's like, let's just have some fun. I was like, I don't think so. This will not do. And it took me, we didn't get a better room. It took me about 15 minutes to simmer down. You see, I was so convinced that moment on our honeymoon could be better. This moment in this room could be better if I could just see the ocean. And you know, I think the story of Jesus and the perfume is a cautionary tale of gratitude. Judas obsesses over what could have been. Same way I was obsessing over what could have been. Goes with us. When we obsess over the house we wish we had, the relationships we wish we had, the body we wish we had, the friends, the job, the church, the adventures, the experiences we wish we had, we so often miss the gift that's right in front of us. Right here, right now. Consider this story at the end of John's letter. Peter has denied, he's abandoned Jesus in his moment of need. He's betrayed Jesus around a campfire three times. Jesus goes to his death knowing his friend has totally betrayed him. And now Jesus is resurrected and they meet again around a campfire. And this is how the story unfolds. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. Third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him the third time. Apparently he hadn't picked up on this point. There was a three thing going on here. Do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you were old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. We talked about that last week, remember? Then he said to him, follow me. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. When Peter saw him, he asked, yeah, Lord, but what about him? I love this story so much. Put the pause button on there. When nothing else in Scripture speaks to me, this story consistently gives and gives and gives to me. It's such a powerful moment, this story between Jesus and Peter. The scene is absolutely perfect. Jesus finds Peter fishing, just like he did at the beginning. This whole scene reeks of new beginnings. They're around a fire, just like when Peter denied Jesus. And then Jesus has this incredibly beautiful ritual of forgiveness. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. And then, Peter, you are going to follow me in extraordinary ways. Jesus lets Peter know, your life has meaning, Peter. Your life will be a distinct story. Jesus lets Peter know that his freedom will be taken from him. He will die honoring Jesus just like he said he would back in the garden. And Jesus ends with, just follow me. And this gorgeous, beautiful moment, instead of drinking it all in, instead of Peter reveling in the grace and tenderness of the moment, instead of being filled with gratitude, Peter blurts out, yeah, what about him? It's like, spoiled. The beauty of the moment just evaporates. It's gone. The moment is ruined. You ever spoiled a moment? I did just last week. It was awful. I was doing a wedding, and we were in a rock garden. And we had gone through the whole shebang, and the bride and groom were right in the middle of exchanging their vows. And they had written their own vows, and let me tell you, these were over the top. Oh, it's great. The groom had been like, one life is not enough with you. When I die, it was just like, my heart will go on, like just mic drop, like. And they're exchanging their vows, and they didn't have a wedding party, so they had given me the box of rings right beforehand. And so hold my little book, and right as they're doing their vows, I know the rings are coming up next. So I'm like, okay, this is going to be a smooth transition. And so I open up the box while they're declaring, my love is more intense than 1,000 suns. They're going on, open the box, and one of the rings falls out. Ding! Hits off a rock, lands to my left. I am freaking out in my head, freaking out. Trying to stay calm, I'm looking. We're in a garden-y thing. I cannot see this ring at all. And I'm like, okay, what do we do? And I'm trying to look, and they're going on. I'm like, yeah, beautiful. And suddenly, this woman in the front row of the wedding, she can see my panic. And seriously, the groom is still going on. The greatest love poetry you've ever heard. And right in the middle, she's like, hey, minister guy, it's to your left. And I'm like, I can't see it. Can't see it. She's like, right there. This guy's like, I would die for you. You know, Brian Adams came on. Everything I do it for you. I'm like, where? Like, right there. I'm like, oh, my goodness. It was just like I totally... By the way, I'm available for weddings. I can and will ruin your special moment. Totally ruin the moment. I feel like this is what Peter does here. He just ruins it. Beautiful. Yeah, what about him? And I love Jesus' response. I can't help but think Jesus must have laughed or rolled his eyes or something. I love how he responds. Jesus answered, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. What is that to you? Love that line. Jesus' response to this question is that one, it's incredibly hard and challenging, and yet it's still filled with grace. It highlights so often the things that keep us from gratitude and joy, and that's this, we're always comparing ourselves to others. Internally, nothing steals joy or gratitude in life more than Peter's question, what about them? And Jesus' line is perfect. What is that to you, Peter? How does that person's path and story affect you in any way, shape, or form, unless you're going to dwell on it? How does that person's path have any bearing whatsoever? Don't worry about them. Stop comparing yourself. Just take care of your own story. Follow me. This question from Jesus haunts me. I find myself so often asking the exact same question that Peter did. What about them? What about him or her? Why do they seem to get a better path than I do? Jesus' biting words here, they kind of echo in my head. I feel like Jesus saying to me, Brad, what if I want that person to be totally successful in life? What if I want them to have the perfect family, the perfect marriage? What if I want them to have a life that's filled with laughter and life? What if I want them to get the promotion or be far more recognized than you? What if I want them to have all the toys, all the fun, all the sex, all the great things in life? What if they never struggle with depression or low self-esteem or addiction? What if they get all the fame? What if they have the perfect body, the perfect children? What if I want them to have the good grades, the privilege, the luck, the health, all the freedom of the world? What exactly is that to you, Brad? That's not your story. That's not for you to worry about. How does that change state of your life at all? One of the most beautiful things to me about marriage is two people become one, share their life together. So it was when Kristen and I got married. It meant that not only did she get me, what a prize, but she inherited my school debt as well, which was substantial. She said, I do. We signed the papers and it was like, all I am is yours, including 20 grand of debt. She loved it. Things only got worse for us in the first year of marriage. She was going to school full-time. I was going to school. I was working part-time. And so our 20 grand over that first year went up in the first year of marriage. And it was basically, as our love grew, so too did our debt. And after that first year, we were both working. We sort of sat down. We said, okay, we need a plan to get out of debt. It needs to be a slow road out. And so we sat down, we made this beautiful plan. Okay, 4, maybe 5 years, we'll be out of debt. And we felt great about it. Felt so good. We had a plan. We can do this together. We are going to have to work hard, but we're in it together. It felt like our first real challenge as a married couple, but we were excited. We can do this together. And then I remember we were in a small group at the time for recently married couples. One evening, finances was the discussion of the small group, and every couple in this group had been married under 2 years, and all of a sudden that evening, our excitement over our plan just dissipated. Everyone was sharing about their financial situation. One couple shared they were so blessed because after school, their parents' wedding gift to them was to pay off their debt. And another couple was like, we've done very well in business these first 2 years. We'll be buying a house with a significant down payment. Interesting. Another couple, they were hardly making any money at all, but this person's grandmother had decided to give them a house. There you go. No mortgage. There's your house. Another couple, they had full scholarships. They hadn't racked up a penny in debt. Around and around the room it went, and it came to us. Oh, Brad and Kristen, tell us about your financial situation. And it's like, well, you know, we're seeing our debt as an opportunity for growth. I remember the drive home that night was ugly. It was just mean. Kristen and I were just livid. Like, who gives somebody a house? Who does that? Who just, there you go, house. My parents paid off my debt. Are you kidding me? Oh, it was just venting. Suddenly, it felt like our lives sucked. Before that meeting, we had been like, our lives are great. We got a nice little plan. And then suddenly, in that moment, everything changed. And the bizarre thing is this. This is what Jesus is trying to point out to Peter. In that moment, nothing had changed for Chris and I, not one thing. We had peace with our debt plan, the path we'd need to take out of it. We were fine. We were excited about life. We were kind of excited because we could only afford lawn chairs at that time. So our apartment was furnished with lawn chairs, and we sort of took it as this sort of symbol of pride. We got lawn chairs to offer people to sit down. And all of a sudden, we felt good, but then it was like, I got a free house. I'm out of debt. And it was like, oh, I hate my life. Until we heard about someone in a similar position to us that had it better, we were fine. And as soon as we did and compared ourselves, everything seemed to fall apart. And I can picture Jesus saying to us, if I want them to start off debt-free in a nice apartment, what's that to you? If I want them to have a house for free, what is that to you? If I want them to be successful in business, what exactly is that to you? You've got your own story to live. And you know, like Peter, I think we always find ourselves measuring ourselves by another person's path or story. It robs us of joy. We miss the gift that's right in front of us. And gratitude is like the antidote to this. It's an internal state of being that shifts our attention from the path of others and what they have and focuses on the gifts that are right in front of us. And I have to add, you know, because if you're here just for 1 week, I don't want this to sound like there aren't things to grieve in life. There are things to grieve in life, things that are genuinely difficult. The past 2 weeks, Matthew and Mark have reminded us, life is difficult. We can expect to find change and suffering on our path. So if you're here only once, I don't want you to think that we're all about happy-go-lucky. This doesn't mean we have to pretend everything's great in life. It doesn't mean we have to be happy about everything. It doesn't mean that we don't name and identify those painful areas in life. But what it does mean, I think, is this. When we live our lives wanting someone else's story, we miss what God is doing and up to in our own story. Have you ever had this happen? Someone in life shares with you their good news, and suddenly their good news becomes your bad news? You ever had that? Like, hey, we're engaged, and you're like, oh, I lose. I'm a loser, all right? Or have you ever said, hey, I got a new job, it pays 6 figures, and I'm working at Google, so it means I get to play ping pong at work, and they make all my meals for me, and you're like, I hate my job, hate it, hate my life. Maybe someone says, oh, I'm traveling to Europe for 6 weeks this summer, and you're like, I'm stuck going to the Ellora Gorge with these people here. My life is so not exciting. Or maybe it's this. Hey, we're pregnant. It's like, oh, congratulations. It's It's great. We've been trying for years to get pregnant. So that's great. Yes, yes, I would love to come to your baby shower where everyone holds babies and does weird baby games. And, you know, that's not a reminder at all for me of the struggle and deep pain I'm going through. So often other people's good news becomes our bad news. You ever had that show up inside of you? Congratulations. Oh. Or how about this? Have you ever had someone's, this is even more sinister, someone's bad news become your good news? Sinners, we're all here together. That's good. I want to show you a picture. This is Steve and me. And where are you? There you are. The only reason I'm telling this story is to remind Steve that he lost to me. Steve and I were at some sort of carnival thing, and he challenged me to climb up a rock wall. And Steve's like, you know, 10 feet taller than me, so I didn't think I stood a chance. And so I reluctantly agreed, and so we started climbing, and he took off, and we were neck and neck, and then he fell. And I was like, yes, yes, take it, take it. By the way, it might look like that kid is schooling me, not a chance. I blew by that kid over there on the left. But Steve fell, and I have never felt so good in my life because I scaled to the top of the wall, winner, victorious. Steve, I wasn't going to forget about that. Anyway, but it's that sort of same situation. Someone else falls in life, and you're like, awesome. Right? I mean, have you ever had something bad happened to someone and it felt good to you? If you've ever felt that inside of you, you know exactly what I mean by sin. That's a weird thing when something bad happens to someone and you feel good. And so sometimes it's like someone says, oh, I lost my job, and you're like, I'm so sorry. And then there's that weird place in your head but going, but maybe that looks good on you. Or someone says, you know, my relationship isn't working in life right now, and somewhere in your shadow self, you're like, I feel like I'm winning. My relationship's fine. I feel like I'm winning. Like, that is weird, dark stuff. And, you know, the thing is this. If we can't learn to ask ourselves, what is that to me? We'll end up consumed by comparing ourselves to others, playing this game of life, and oftentimes the weird thing is the other people don't even know the rules. We're playing a game with people. They don't know the rules. We spend all our time comparing ourselves to others, measuring up, trying to keep score. We create, I would say, personal hells for ourselves. And I don't think we can ever know true friendship, true community, if we don't kill that beast inside of us now. Because life becomes all about us, and are we winning? I know on a personal level, this is a huge struggle for me. I think beyond what is normal, compare myself to others, and it's stealing my joy, it's stealing my happiness. I always feel like I'm trying to measure up to something, playing games with people they don't even know we're playing. So I've got a plan. After our last service, I'm hopping on a plane, and I'm heading deep into the wilderness again, and I'm going to try to kill that beast within me because it is honestly robbing me of gratitude and joy and happiness. Because if we can't stop comparing ourselves to others, we will forever, ever live constantly asking the question, what about them? What about them? And I keep hearing Jesus' words say, what is that to you? You know, if you don't love the life you've been given, it'll become the enemy of the one you wish you had. Jesus reminds Peter so powerfully that his life is a story. Your life is headed somewhere. It's got depth and meaning to it. And when Peter was tempted to look enviously on others, Jesus cautions him. What is that to you? Comparing yourselves to others. Look at the content of your own life. Find the gift and gratitude there. And so with these two cautionary tales, I think John reminds us to come to the garden and rest and rejuvenate and find it within ourselves to focus on the things we can be grateful for on our own paths. Life is full of change. Life is full of suffering, but can also be full of joy and gratitude. I found this quote in Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. She found this quote writing by a man named Jack Gilbert. This quote is penetratingly powerful to me. I love it. Jack Gilbert writes, "We must risk delight. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world." There's a profound challenge here. to know joy, delight, happiness, celebration. It seems clear that what we all must do is this, is become more grateful. Gratitude. Learn to celebrate, enjoy, be grateful. I'm going to ask the band to come and close us in a song as I leave us with two gratitude challenges. The first is this. Actually, can I have a few people maybe hand these out? I want to put one of these in everybody's hands. Thank you, sir. That's very kind. Thank you, Warren. Hopefully that'll be enough there. Take a look at this. This is our third year where the festival is happening. And the festival is all about our end of year. It's simply a way to say we're going to enjoy life. If you take a look at this Thursday night, we're going to have a bonfire and s'mores. There's perhaps nothing more delightful than campfires. Friday night is our annual Nexus once-in-a-lifetime event, a food and wine feast at the Griffins. And if you've been there the past 2 years, you will know this is a moment of joy. You don't want to miss this. They will fill you with the best food and wine possible. On Saturday at the Karens, we've got Kid Fest for families, Burger Fest, and then a Euchre Fest, and I guarantee you I will win Euchre Fest. So, see, there's me again. I always want to win, right? Yikes, that's weird. All right, I'll be okay. I won't compare myself with others, maybe for a moment. Man, that's weird. All right, Saturday, the Summer Christmas Potluck Party Extravaganza at the Taylors. This cracks me up. Bronson has put in here, now with even more ganza, because I had been wondering about that. I thought, you know, we could use a little bit more ganza. So, no one got that. Yeah, you got to read the card. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And then Sunday, our last Sunday here, we're going to have brunch and then our season finale and a little snacks and finger food after. On the back, you'll find our summer programming. Let me say one thing about this. Listen, I know how difficult it is to show up to somebody's house when you don't know them. And if you're introverted like me, I'm deeply introverted, this will cause you anxiety to, like, oh my goodness. Here's what I'm going to say. Take the gamble. Come. I know it's hard. I know it is. I get it. But there's something profoundly healthy about celebrating, enjoying life with others. This festival is about enjoying life to the maximum. Good food, great fun, great people. And you know me, so come and say hello. Asking you, come, take the risk, and we will delight in life together. Finally, let's walk away from here with perhaps a gratitude practice this week to put into place. Five areas of gratitude I want to ask you to practice. First is this, the people you live with or spend the most time with, because those are the ones that we tend to become overly familiar with, and we lose our gratitude and joy for the people closest to us, I think the easiest. Familiarity breeds contempt. And so I want to ask you to take a moment and somehow express gratitude to the people closest to you, whoever that is. Second, maybe the people who have influenced your life the most. Take some time to reflect on the people who have influenced you the most. And maybe send some sort of gratitude, some thanks to them for that. Third, and this is weird, but I'm going to ask you what you're grateful for about Nexus. What you're grateful for about this community. However you want to do that, I want to challenge you to express gratitude for what this is. And then these last two might be the most difficult, but number four, you. You. What exactly about you are you grateful for? And that can be incredibly difficult, I think, for many of us to think about, what do you mean being grateful for myself? What is it? Your body, your personality, your mind, whatever it is. Challenge you to take the risk of enjoying yourself and being grateful for that. And finally, God. And I think this could be difficult for a community like ours, because in a skeptical community like this, I think we're very comfortable expressing our doubts to God. I think that comes easy. I'm not sure expressing gratitude to God feels as easy as that. So whatever that looks like for you this week, those five things, because here's what this body of research around gratitude, what I think John points us to. You want to be happy, know joy, say thanks. Learn to say thanks. And so I'm just going to put that in our pipes for us to smoke, and pipes around my mind for some reason. The band is going to do a song. Oh, my goodness, I got to get out of here. All right, so let's just close after this. Thank you, those visiting Baby Dedication. I appreciate you being here, and want to thank you for this. This is a beautiful song by Josh Garrels. So take it away.